Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How did America's 20th century struggle over immigration reform set the stage for today's immigration debates? Jialin Yang will join us to talk about her book, One Mighty and Irresistible Tide. Is now the time to simplify your life? Our help desk columnist, Judith Newman, will be here to talk about books that try to get you down to the essentials. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, our critics will join us for the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's May 21st. I'm Pamela Paul. Jialin Yang joins us now. She is a deputy editor on the National Desk at The Times and the author of a new book called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. Jialin, thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be here.
So your day job is as a deputy editor on the National Desk at the New York Times. And I think you are the first deputy editor of the National Desk of the New York Times to be on the podcast. So I want to ask you a kind of two-part question. Just first, what is your job normally like? And then I'm curious to hear just a little bit about what it's like these days.
Yeah, the normal times seem like a very distant past. So, I mean, and in fact, my job never feels normal. And the reason is, so I help oversee the National Desk, which does coverage all across the country. We have people in California, someone in Seattle, someone in Texas. We've got people in Boston. So we've got correspondents across the country. And we basically cover everything that's happening, I'd say, outside of kind of official Washington. So any mass shooting, hurricanes, the future of American religion, immigration, of course, we cover.
Right. So education.
Education, yes. So it's a lot of national issues, and it's a lot of kind of thinking about how do we really capture what is happening on the ground in this very large, complex, changing country. And writing a book of history, it really kind of struck me like we are working on stories that historians will probably read, and they will be trying to understand what was going on in 2018, what was going on in 2020 in America. And a lot of what we do, I like to think, is actually feeding into that understanding currently and for the future.
First draft of history.
Yes.
Do you divide your work on the National Desk by region, by issue? Do you oversee particular sections of the country or areas of coverage?
Yeah. So we have editors who oversee the West, editors who oversee the South, sort of coverage regional areas. I don't do that. I do more stories that are trying to get at actually kind of how our politics, I would say, are shaped by what's happening around the country. So, for instance, I edit our religion reporter, Elizabeth Diaz, who does really rich reporting about evangelicals, about just how are people seeing their leaders and where their country is headed, not because they're reduced to Trump voters or not Trump voters, but just what are they seeing in their lives? Like, how are things going? What's shaping their cultural views? And how do they see where the country's headed? And that kind of reporting, which I think, you know, certainly out of the 2016 election, the urgency for that sort of reporting just sort of never became more clear, right? We just have to have a handle on the country and how it feels. And so I kind of think of a lot of the work I do is in that vein.
Sort of looking at broader issues that are shaping our politics and our society.
Yes.
On a national level.
Yes.
That sounds fun and interesting. What is your job like right now?
It is pandemic all the time, and we seem to be living through maybe the next Great Depression. So there's plenty to do, and we are trying to get our heads around how this whole event is going to change our country forever, right? We sort of all went underground for a certain period of time, thinking that we'd all come back to something that felt maybe like what it was like before. And I think with every passing week, that previous American life just for me is feeling more and more distant. And now journalistically, the challenge that I think is actually quite exciting is to think about what does our country look like at the other side of this and what has changed forever. And in fact, it's kind of hard to imagine anything not being changed forever right now.
Right.
But, you know, the future of college education, like what is campus life going to be like from here on out? What is religious life going to be like? Will people do more online worshiping? Are people going to go more anti-immigrant, right? Does this unleash more xenophobia? We've already seen anti-Asian attacks. Does this affect our immigration debate, which was already so fraught? I think the pandemic too is like, it's an incredible time to think about our country because it's revealing so many things that I think were always happening, right? You think about the meatpacking plants, like that was always happening, right? Those undocumented immigrants. We never thought about them. We just went to the grocery store, we bought our meat, we went home. And now every piece of that chain of events, right? Every human connection, every human step and everything that we interact with is being revealed.
Be an interesting time to go back and like read Sinclair Lewis right now.
I thought about that. Yeah, absolutely. That's still going on. And I think we just treated a lot of people and a lot of processes and things as invisible, or at least I did, I think. And everything is being made visible right now.
So even before the pandemic, you had a really busy job. I have to ask this question of everyone who writes a book while they're at the New York Times, because I mean, how do you do it? Did you take a book leave? Did you work at the crack of dawn? What was your process?
I took no book leave. I just
Oh, my
worked.
God. Okay. I just want listeners to appreciate that amid all the school shootings and the hurricanes and tornadoes and seismic shifts. Okay, go on. How did that work?
I also was pregnant. I mean, when I look back, it is actually insane that I did this. And even crazier, my husband was working on a book too, and his book comes out the same day as mine. So
what?
We both.
Okay, wait. What's your husband's book?
His book is called The Price of Peace, and it's an intellectual biography of John Maynard Keynes, the economist.
Oh, excellent.
And it comes out the same day by total fluke from Random House, different publisher. I think because we were both rushing to get our books done before the baby arrived. So we were just around the clock every weekend, every vacation was like, although I have to say, going to presidential libraries on your vacation, maybe I'm just a huge, huge dork, but I found that to be a great way to spend vacations. I mean, you get to travel to interesting places and go through papers and visit museums and presidential libraries. You know, for anyone who hasn't been to them, I can't recommend them enough. They're so much fun.
Oh, just the sound of the word library right now fills me with longing. Question that I want to ask for your husband's sake, give him a shout out. What's his name? So if people are interested in looking at that book,
Zachary D. Carter.
All right. So we have two books to hear about on this segment. Let's talk about why this book for you, because it's interesting. You chose to write a book that is grounded in the 20th century while you're dealing with, and your national coverage, immigration right now. But you have a personal connection to the subject. Do you want to talk about that?
I became interested because it really started with a visit to the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum. And I've always been interested in LBJ's presidency. I mean, I think a lot of us are. And I was particularly a huge fan of reading books about the civil rights movement and the 50s and 60s. The Taylor Branch books for me are just, you know, incredible achievements of writing and history. And when I was at the library, I wanted to see in the museum, I wanted to see more based on my interest on that. And I was surprised to see this reference to a law that I really had barely heard of before, if I'd even heard of it before, I have to confess, called the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. And in that museum, there's this amazing room where they sort of go through all of LBJ's accomplishments, right? Everything from Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, to creating the Public Broadcasting Corporation, all the ways in which his legacy has touched American life. And there's a mention of this law. And there's just a line in that room that just says, like, you know, this law was passed and it helps explain why there are so many Asian Americans in this country. And I kind of stopped cold and thought, huh, I wonder if my family is connected somehow to this law. Does this law explain somehow why we're here? And this was early 2016. This was when Trump was still running for president. You know, his election just seemed like a total long shot still. And so I began to dig just out of a sense of almost, it was a way of learning a genealogy. Like, it's not learning who your grandfather is or your great grandfather, but it was a sort of way of tying my family and its story to this country and its history, which I love learning about so much. And the more I learned, the more I thought, you know, this information seems strangely very hard to find. I mean, there are incredible immigration historians who do this work, but as a sort of popular understanding of the history, I was just amazed that, you know, very few people I talked to had ever heard of it. We talk about our demographic future all the time, I feel like, right? That there's this like this clock ticking and white Americans will, you know, someday not too far in the future become a minority of Americans and sort of fall under 50%. We talked about that all the time, but we hadn't really grappled with how we got here. Like, why are there so many Asian Americans? Why are there so many Latin Americans? Why did I grow up in Northern Virginia, you know, where I'm sitting now, trying to stay safe for the pandemic? Why did I grow up with people from Afghanistan, from Iran, like families from all over the world? And I think I just took it for granted. Like, it just seemed like we're a nation of immigrants. So of course these people are all around me. But the more I learned, the more I realized it could have easily not happened, right? My family could easily have not been here or allowed to be here, just as right now we're seeing laws being made and remade that control the fates of all kinds of families.
Well, it's interesting too, because the way that immigration history was taught in schools, probably until quite recently, was that, you know, in a kind of 19th century setting that maybe went up to the end of World War II, which is that you had the wave of Irish followed by, you know, in the potato famine, then you learned about the Italians and you learned about politics in the city and how that changed, and then refugees and the attempts to escape Hitler's Germany and the Soviet Union. But after that, at least in my own education, it kind of stopped. And we don't hear about these later laws, and we don't hear about immigration really from outside Europe.
Yes. And I was amazed to think about and learn just how recent this conception of like a nation of immigrants is actually. Like, I learned it's from the 1950s. That before that, you know, this historian, Oscar Hanlon, who wrote a book that came out in the early 50s called The Uprooted, which won a Pulitzer Prize for a while, I think it was assigned in a lot of schools, was this very powerful and politically influential book that traced the history that you just described, right? The waves of European immigration, how each wave changed America. That fed into JFK's book, A Nation of Immigrants. But that idea is fairly modern. And before that, you know, you could argue that the root of the American spirit, people thought about as coming from like the Wild West, right? That was sort of like the nationalist mythology. This notion of immigrants is something of a invention is too far afield, I think, but like that was the result of historians doing work and doing political work, because Oscar Hanlon himself got involved in some of these political debates and people used this new nationalism, I would call it, to try to change our country's immigration laws. And we are living in that, in the legacy of that work. But yes, the recent waves now that we see, I mean, it's astonishing. We are now at the highest percentage of foreign-born Americans since that huge wave between 1880 and 1920 of Italians and Jews and other Europeans, right? We're back at that level.
Let's start then where your book starts. I mean, you choose a very specific framework, 1924 to 1965, presumably bookended by these two major congressional acts. Let's start with the Immigration Act of 1924. What did that establish? How did it come about? Who's behind it?
It's a really important law because before it, we basically had open borders, which is kind of hard to imagine now, given how much we debate immigration, but really it was quite open. There was a literacy test that people added to try to restrict immigration. Our border with Mexico was basically open. Like, there weren't real limits. You would show up at Ellis Island if you could, you know, make the journey, and someone would check your health, and, you know, you didn't even need a visa to come in, right? You really just showed up at a coastline, at a port, and we decided whether you could come in. And very few people were turned away, very, very small percentage. So 1924 is a response to this historic wave of Jews, Italians, other Europeans, and really changing the country. They changed New York, right? They overnight, New York became filled with all these people who worshipped different religions, they spoke different languages, they ate different food. And there was kind of a backlash, a nativist backlash that said, whoa, 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 these people are changing our country too quickly. We have to restrict immigration. And we not only have to restrict it, we have to decide that certain ethnicities are more preferred to be here than others. So we're going to literally rank, we want people from Northern and Western Europe. we don't really want people from Southern and Eastern Europe anymore. They're not really the right type of people. We have the science to back it up. This is the eugenics movement is very powerful at this time. You've got people on the Upper East Side who are, you know, I'd say they're just sort of snobs, right? They're like, oh, these people are really sort of the unwashed masses. Like, we don't want them. And they put in these ethnic quotas in 1924 that say, you know, we want most people from this part of Europe, almost no one from these parts, and Asia, forget about it.
So there was this history of this fear and propaganda around the idea of yellow peril. When did that originate? And was that part of what fed into this anti-Asian clause in this act?
The most important law to know when you're thinking about anti-Asian immigration history is, of course, the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which was really kind of an early bellwether for the future of immigration, because this was the first federal law that singled out an ethnicity and said, we don't want you here. They banned Chinese laborers in particular. And after that law kind of set that tone, Asians were often singled out as a group that this country did not want. And so you had the Chinese were excluded, then a lot of Japanese and Korean immigrants kind of came in their wake to take the jobs that were no longer being given to Chinese laborers. There was a backlash to that, in particular out west in California and the Pacific Northwest. And as part of this debate, which was primarily about Europe, there was also coming from California, this continued anti-Asian racism. And so that became part of this law too. And it's really interesting. They basically wrote it in without saying it. They said, if you can't naturalize and become a citizen, you can't come here. And there had just been a Supreme Court ruling saying that this Japanese immigrant who dearly wanted to become an American citizen could not because he was not white. And so that was a way of writing into our laws in this kind of interesting way that actually has its own logic, right? It's like, if you can't naturalize, then like, why are you even coming here? It just so happened, you know, not only conveniently, but very much by design, they were thinking about Asian immigrants. They did not want them here.
Today, of course, one of the major groups that is feeling that deliberate exclusion are Latin Americans. Were they at all addressed in that initial 1924 act?
They came up really only in passing. You know, there were people who said, the nativists, right? They were like, if we don't want Asians, if we don't want Jews and Italians, surely we don't want Mexicans either. But the agricultural industry, which continues to be very powerful, basically spoke up and said, you can't restrict that. They are too vital for our industry. We've got to keep this free flow of labor. And so it didn't really, there weren't restrictions added. And at the time, also, I was sort of amazed to learn, there weren't even numerical restrictions on how many people could come from the Western Hemisphere altogether. So it seemed foreign at the time to people that you would actually create numerical caps on how many people could come from Mexico. Again, like kind of shocking given the debate now. But it also, in addition to agricultural interests, it just seemed like bad neighborly foreign policy. You know, like these are your neighbors. You can't pass laws that say to them, oh, you know, you're undesirable. We can only take in so many of you. It seemed like an unfriendly gesture to your neighbors. And I think that was something else I learned, that foreign policy was just often a huge factor in our laws. So, you know, even when they wanted to do this anti-Asian ban, the pushback from the White House was, this is not good for our relationship with Japan. And likewise with Mexican immigration and Latin American immigration, it seemed like, you know, we really can't pass laws that are rude and insulting to our neighbors.
So the Immigration Act of 1924, did this pass easily? Was it a big fight? And what was the immediate reaction in the country?
It passed pretty easily. You know, other attempts to restrict immigration had been much, much harder, but the country is coming off of World War I. There's a ton of upheaval in the country, a lot of racial upheaval and suspicion of communists and political radicals. So in this moment, it really does, it really goes through without much trouble. And it immediately has an impact. The number of people who show up at Ellis Island totally plummets because now you need to get a visa. You need to line up at a consulate. This was a new system. And we basically stopped taking in a lot of immigrants. And so the percentage of foreign-born Americans continues to drop and drop and drop. And I was also astonished to learn that there were so few immigrants coming that this whole notion of having lots of immigrants as part of Americans, you know, of American life and the fabric of American cultural and political life, that idea just sort of died. Like it seemed like that was a thing of the past. This whole idea of the melting pot was over. And now we're just going to keep our country sort of frozen in time ethnically as predominantly white Anglo-Saxon. We've got some Jews and Italians who came in this, you know, in this way, but we put a stop to that. And this is what we have. And we're going to assimilate all these people. And it really kind of, I think, put into place and set into place this idea of being white in America that kind of expanded. Like, it wasn't just Protestants anymore. It could be Catholics. It could be Jews. And this whole idea of whether you could count as white, I think it really expanded in part because they sort of stopped admitting people. And you have World War II and people go to fight together. And so for this whole period, I think our whole idea of who gets to be American changes because of who gets to be white after these restrictions.
What did you learn through researching this book that most informed the way you think about immigration and our current debates around immigration right now?
I think I learned that rather than imagining us as a country that has always welcomed immigrants and that we are just sort of set in stone as a nation of immigrants, as that really powerful kind of nationalist ideal suggests, we have a knob that we turn back and forth all the time over how many people we want here, who we want here, and all these nitty-gritty questions about what makes us American. And they have to do with your ethnicity. They have to do with your education level. They have to do with whether you have family here, all these things that we talk about. We turn the knob back and forth. And I think that people like Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions, to some degree, I think they know this history. They know that in the past, we have stopped immigrants of a certain kind from coming in this country, and we can stop them again.
They know the knobs to turn.
They know the knobs to turn. They know this history. They know that 1965 was a turning point, and it must be unwound. I don't know if they literally know that, but I think if you look at the history, you can't help but understand how contingent all of it is. It's not a given that your family got to come here at any point in American history, and certainly not now when we have all these laws. And so the laws have been changed, and they can be changed again.
All right. Jalen, thank you so much for being here. You are a busy person with your job as a deputy editor on National, your new baby, your husband's new book, your new book. The book, again, is called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965 by Jalen Yang. Jalen, thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. Judith Newman, our help desk columnist, joins us now from New York. Judith, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, giving me something to do this morning.
So you have a really fun topic with this column, Simplifying Your Life, a subject that, like all subjects probably, has taken on new meaning. How did you choose the subject? Because I think you did it pre our current situation.
I did. When I decided a couple of months ago, I saw all of these books out about simplifying your life. And it didn't really dawn on me that, you know, a worldwide pandemic would simplify our lives for us. So, you know, I didn't think, you know, wouldn't that be hilarious just to be writing about simplifying? And that's what happened. But I do think it has some bearing on this time a little bit. I know, as I say, that it feels like reading diet books during a famine. But there is something very anxiety producing about forced leisure too. So I don't think it hurts us to kind of sit down and think about how, when this ends, we can kind of pare down certain aspects of our lives.
All right. I'm going to run through the four titles of the books that you write about, and then we'll go a little bit into each of them. The first is called Simply Living Well, A Guide to Creating a Natural Low-Waste Home by Julia Watkins. Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, Paul Offit. That might be an interesting one for the moment. Project 333, The Minimalist Fashion Challenge That Proves Less is So Much More by Courtney Carver. And finally, The Buy Nothing, Get Everything Plan, Discover the Joy of Spending Less, Sharing More, and Living Generously by Liesl Clark and Rebecca Rockefeller. So I remember back in the 1990s, I bought this book. It was a big bestseller at the time. It was called Simplify Your Life. It was this little square cornflower blue book that I thought at the time, this will change everything. Like, here is the key.
Was there one or two things that you took away from that adorable little book that did allow you to simplify your life?
Well, you know what I took away from that experience, which is an experience I take away from a lot of self-help, and that's that simply buying the book makes me feel like half the job is done. You know, like, okay, I can check that off my list because the intention is there. And it was one of those books too. It's probably one of the first books that I bought for the sake of kind of having it around. It was like, you know, in the way that people bought A Brief History of Time, the Stephen Hawking book, like they just wanted to own
it. And nobody read it. Right. Remember Gödel, Escher, Bach? Remember that book on everybody's table? And I don't know a single person who ever read it.
Right. There are those books. It's the, you know, Thomas Piketty phenomenon. But for me, Simplify Your Life was that book. And I guess what I'm wondering is, what has changed since the 1990s? How have these books evolved? Are there a bunch of them now? Is there a new wave?
There is a new wave of books. I didn't even hit on all of the books that I read for this. There are books about simplifying your work life as well as just your home life.
Well, that's done.
And yeah, yeah, that's kind of why they're not in the column. That just seemed like I was mocking the universe, so I didn't put them in. But what has changed may not be so much the day-to-day, but our relationship to the day-to-day. We want to be successful, ambitious people. We want to get a lot done, whether it's in the home or in the office, but we don't want to have heart attacks while doing it. We want to have a kind of a focus and a calm. And whether these books can deliver that is, of course, a big question mark, but I think that that's the purpose of a lot of them. And it's also to try to break through the noise, whether the noise is about the medical noise, in a sense, what it is that we're constantly told because we're on the internet, we're on social media, or just the domestic noise of what it is that actually will make us happy in our own homes. I don't think we can Marie Kondo our way out of anxiety, but it's a good first step.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I just did that with my closet, basically, because as our listeners know, my closet is my current podcast studio, and it was a real mess. So I condoed the shoes, at least on the floor where I sit.
Is it better? Are you happier?
It's so much better. I have more joy. I do. I do. I'm going to take a photo of this and post it to Instagram. Well, let's jump right into the first book, because that one sounds the kind of closest to the Marie Kondo aesthetic. Simply Living Well, A Guide to Creating a Natural Low-Waste Home by Julia Watkins. What's in this book?
She starts this book by saying, this is a book your grandmother could have given you. And so she's wanting very much to have us know that there is a tremendous amount of waste in our lives that doesn't add to our happiness. She calls it the five R's of zero waste, which are refuse, reduce, reuse, recycle, and rot. And that, if you're less alliterative, that she means compost. And she shows you how you can incorporate all of these ideas into your life. I mean, for one thing, for me, it was just a pleasure to read a book that didn't have the words disinfectant wipes in it at this point. But that aside, she really talks about how we have a linear economy when it comes to resources, how they are extracted, they're processed, they're consumed, and they're discarded. And she's talking more about creating a circular economy where at least some of what you do aligns with a more sort of a natural cycle of regeneration. So in other words, it's just a huge compilation of ways that you can reuse things in your house, whether it's something I actually tried, which was very nice, like the simmer pot. It's a, you know, how to use all sorts of waste materials. In this case, the simmer pot for me was about taking stuff that absolutely did not work in certain contexts. In my case, lavender and cinnamon sticks do not kill moths, I'm here to tell you. I don't know who came up
really?
With that idea, but they don't. Yeah.
What about ants?
I don't know about ants being in the city, but I can always tell you, no effect on moths. But go ahead, go knock yourself out, try them on ants. All I know is that they smell good and that if you put them on a little pot and you at least have the pleasure of knowing that something has happened to the enormous amount of lavender that you've bought, apparently to make the lives of moths more pleasant, because that's what it seems to do. So a lot of the things that she suggests, just looking at the recipe for ketchup, 12 ingredients for ketchup, it makes me just want to lie down.
Yeah, there's nothing simple about that.
Right. The simplicity comes not exactly in saving time, let's put it that way, but it comes in that you have the satisfaction of not wasting a lot of stuff. I mean, I didn't know you could repurpose eggshells. You soak them in apple cider for a couple of days and they treat minor skin irritations and itchy skin. I'm told I did not do this. I'm told that it actually does work. I kind of go immediately to CVS and go for the Benadryl. But I think that it's good to know that you can do this and you can give it a try. It just means a life with a lot of cider vinegar and cheesecloth in your house. I don't know why, but cheesecloth seems to figure into a lot of these.
Yeah, that's a word I've never liked.
It sounds like something unpleasant is going to happen.
Yeah, it's like breadfruit. You know, it's two words that don't go together. But while we're on the topic of medicine, let's switch over to Paul Offit's Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, because you cited a really interesting fact about fever reducers.
Yes. And we actually heard in the very interesting exchange between Deborah Burke and Trump, when he was talking about disinfectant and light being shunned into the body as a possible cure for COVID, a moment that will go down in history, in addition to just looking horrified, she said what is in fact true and what is talked about in this book is that fever has a purpose. Fever kills virus. And what he says in this book that we have to take to heart is that sometimes you've got to let a fever run a little bit, and that if you are prolonging the course of an illness if you immediately go for the fever reducers. Now, what he doesn't say is when do you actually go for the fever reducers? Like what is he doesn't name a number. Like I'd like to say that it's pretty safe if you have 104 fever and you're hallucinating, you should probably be taking fever reducers. But he is indicating that if your fever is 100, 101, put up with the unpleasantness because that is helping your body, which I find fascinating.
Let's go to Courtney Carver's Project 333, the minimalist fashion challenge that proves less is so much more. I mean, what's this number, 333?
Well, essentially what she is proposing is that all of us can get by with 33 items to wear, including accessories, and we should pare this down over the course of 3 months. In other words, 33 items for 3 months, and that will simplify our lives and take a lot of the emotional angst out of getting dressed in the morning.
So this book feels like the most ill-adapted to the coronavirus season, as it were, because I don't know what you're wearing around your house or apartment.
It's like 111.
Yeah, but for exactly. me, right, I was going to say 33 sounds like an awful lot.
33 is a lot. Yes, that's true. And I think for me, this whole time has been partially about getting wear out of clothing that I can't wear outdoors. Like right now, I'm rocking my Michael Avenatti 2020 t-shirt, which probably, you know, in a moment of enthusiasm, it's not going to see the light of day. But needless to say, the 33 is ample amounts of clothing for our time. In fact, almost too much. But that is rare. And we all look in our closets and see stuff that we don't need and we don't want. But I have to ask this question. I guess I felt a little dubious about it because it seemed to suggest that everybody is an emotional shopper. And the suggestions of things like throw out anything that's been in your closet for more than a couple of months that has tags on it. And I think to myself, having clothing I haven't worn gives me joy. You know, it's like money in the bank to me.
All right. Well, it sounds like Judith Watkins of Simply Living Well would not look too kindly on that throwing out the clothing item with tags still on it.
Probably not. But of course, the idea would be that you recycle it in some kind of interesting way, or you give it away. Certainly, you don't just chuck it. For me, the whole dubious aspect of this is that minimalism works very well for some people. I talk about, in this point, Elizabeth Warren is the genius of minimalist dressing. But maximalism works very well for other people. The rumor that a lobbyist I know told me is that Nancy Pelosi, she not only manages to match her necklaces with her dresses and so forth, but she does it brilliantly. But she may have some help. The rumor is that Nancy Pelosi's husband loves to dress her and that he does a lot of her shopping for her, in which case she's maybe the luckiest woman in the world.
All right. Well, she would run into trouble with your last pair of authors, Liesl Clark and Rebecca Rockefeller, who wrote the Buy Nothing, Get Everything plan, Discover the Joy of Spending Less, Sharing More, and Living Generously. This feels very COVID friendly. What's this book about?
The whole idea is we have, according to the authors, about 300,000 individual items in our house on average. I don't know how they reach that. They must count every paperclip, but whatever it is, that seems to be the number. And wouldn't it be wonderful if so many items, particularly, you know, plastic items and so forth, or baby items, we didn't just chuck them, but that we actually had a micro community of people who were into giving and getting them. And unbeknownst to me, there are already established all of these Buy Nothing communities, and they're on Facebook, and you can look them up based on your area. And a small group of people constantly have stuff they either want to give or they want to get. And my problem with this is that it's very easy for me to give things, but it's also easier for me to take things into my house. So I had to debate about somebody offering all their Beanie Babies. I was thinking, surely they would be cute someplace. Or, you know, every time I see an object that has an owl on it, I keep thinking, I need that. So I have to stop myself. But the point is, to me, the whole notion of this is actually a pretty great one. I live in New York City. There are many of these groups around the city, but I invite people to look on Facebook and see what is going on in their community. Of course, there's drama in these little groups too. They're the people who always raise their hand a little too quickly for stuff. But there's also a great generosity and a satisfaction to that kind of lifestyle. You can't do it for everything, but you can do it for a lot of stuff. And as I said in a piece I did, somebody was offering their Metro card because we couldn't go anywhere. We can't go anywhere. So she was offering a Metro card, and an essential worker, I believe it was a nurse, got first dibs. And so that to me is the perfect kind of simplification.
Well, let's end on that perfect simple note. Judith, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Judith Newman is our help desk columnist. Alexander Alter joins us now with some news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
Anytime something big happens, many books happen too. I'm assuming that's the same thing with our current pandemic.
Yes, we are starting to see the first wave of pandemic books coming in and at lightning speed. As you know, publishing is often an industry that moves at a glacial pace. Their editors are typically buying things that come out in a year or 2 years or 10 years. And in just a few months, publishers and authors have turned around really quick books about the pandemic, which have a great range of content, everything from a poetry collection from Knopf, which has poets reflecting on quarantine, on grief, on how strange the world has become, to quick books about the science of COVID-19, to diaries of lockdown in Wuhan by the Chinese author Fang Fang. There's other ones in the works, you can imagine. I mean, I think there's going to be a deluge. And so the interesting question for publishers is, how do you handle kind of this quickly evolving crisis when you're trying to capture it either in literature or literary nonfiction or a science book, because the information is changing so quickly? So I think with these quick books, what we're seeing is publishers and authors are focusing on sort of a discrete area that's already occurred, sort of how the virus first emerged, how it spread so quickly, things that they can sort of get their hands around, or people's personal reflections, which are very sort of introspective and subjective and will not be held up to scrutiny years from now to say like, oh, you got the science wrong on that. I think the harder books to publish are going to be the ones that are taking a macro view of the crisis, like the books about the economy, the political fallout, because that is a story that is not played out yet and nobody knows how it's going to end. And then, of course, there's the matter of all of these books coming out at once and how big is the appetite for reading about something that we're all living through that's making us so anxious.
I guess the challenge with those longer term books, and the reason why we're seeing deals happen right now, is that we know they're going to be written and people kind of want to stake a claim, even if their book isn't going to come out for 2 or 3 years. They want to let it be known, hey, X major journalist or X excellent narrative nonfiction story writer is on the case. They have their deal. So everybody else stand down. Is that what you're saying too?
I think exactly what you're saying. I mean, I think a writer who everyone wants to hear from on this crisis is David Quammen. He's already published a book about cross-species infections, how diseases that take root in one species can jump to humans and spread into a pandemic. So he was sort of perfectly situated to tackle this subject. And he sold a book that will be coming out next year, I believe. They're trying to do it pretty quickly, to Simon & Schuster. And that book will explore how COVID-19 took root in human hosts and how it spread. So he's somebody who I think is a real authority in the field. Likewise, Deborah McKenzie, who's a science journalist who specializes in infectious diseases, quickly sold a book to Hachette. Her book was on an accelerated schedule, is actually coming out in June as an ebook and as a hardcover at the end of July. So she's really staking a claim. But I think what you're saying is exactly right. I mean, the publishers I spoke to for this story, some of them said, we're getting so many submissions, we're seeing so many proposals, and we're being very cautious because, as we've seen with books about major events, including the 2016 election and its aftermath and all those White House tell-alls that came out from former administration officials, publishers know that they could have a huge hit and then they could have the defining narrative of the era, or, you know, their book could get lost in this swamp and sea of books on a similar subject. And so the question is, how do you make that calculation? And often, you know, getting the big name is kind of a foolproof way to handle that.
It sounds like the new publishing trajectory is ebook first, then the print book, which is kind of a change from before. But I'm assuming that's because without as much of a brick and mortar retail presence, without libraries, publishers are a little bit more heavily weighing towards ebooks than they normally would.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I also just think production-wise, when you're crashing a book, it's a lot easier once you have the EPUB file to sort of release it if timeliness is the most important thing. Of course, there's the risk of cannibalizing future print sales. Publishers make much more from hardcover sales, but I think in this case, the desire to get stuff out quickly has outweighed that calculation. And of course, as you say, a lot of physical bookstores are still closed. So it might be the most convenient medium too for readers to get these books.
Are you going into the skid? Like, are you reading about previous pandemics or the current pandemic, Alexandra, in your copious spare time?
In my copious spare time, I think I mentioned on the podcast before that I did love Lawrence Wright's book, which, while not about a previous pandemic or the current one, is a fictional narrative about a pandemic, which is bizarrely similar to the one that we're living through. Things get much worse in his fictional world, and I'm very much hoping that we don't go down that route. But there's a fascinating amount of science because he is a nonfiction writer and he did a tremendous amount of research. And so the information about viruses and how they spread, I found to be very compelling. Actually, if I can editorialize here, more so than the character development, which was wanting. But the science in the book is fascinating. And I think, you know, if I had even more copious spare time, I would love to read John Barry. His book on the 1918 flu has been, I think, back on the bestseller list. And a lot of people are looking to past pandemics to see how we can put this in context and what the end of it might look like.
All right. Well, I think nobody knows the ending, but thanks for letting us know the books that will at least tell us about the beginning. Alexandra, a pleasure having you.
Thanks for having me.
Our critics, Dwight Garner and Jennifer Salai, join us now to talk about the books they are reading and reviewing. Hey, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
Dwight, let's start with you because you did something that we all like, which is that you gave a negative review, which in a way means one less book to read. at its best.
I reviewed Rodham, Hillary Rodham Clinton. There's a new novel by Curtis Sittenfeld, who's a wonderful writer. And it's a novel seen from her point of view. And the novel presents a counterfactual. It asks the reader what would happen if Hillary Rodham's life, were just the same. She grew up where she did, went to Wellesley, went to Yale Law School, met Bill Clinton. But when he asked her to marry him, she said no. And so their lives fork at this point in the novel. And I wouldn't want to give too much away of what happens, but let's just say that she ends up in Chicago and she has a flourishing career, very active, very impressive. And she ends up in politics and ends up running for president again. And it's interesting.
I mean, it's a great premise.
It is. And one of the book's premises, which I like a lot, is that Bill Clinton had earlier sexual scandals, nothing to do. I mean, they weren't married, Bill and Hillary. And so Curtis proposes that instead of Clinton winning in 1992, George Bush won a second term, George H.W. Bush. And then in 1996, Jerry Brown and Bob Kerry won the election. And then in 2000 and 2004, John McCain was president with Sam Brownback as his vice president. And then she picks up with Barack Obama in 2008 and in 2012.
So it's interesting that she chose to name the book Rodham.
Yeah, well, as I say in my review, it's kind of a truism in politics that if you can get voters to call you by your first name, like Boris Johnson, let's say, or an affectionate nickname like Ike, it usually augurs well for your prospects because, you know, a first name is sort of, you know, it's familiarity. So it didn't work for Hillary, of course, in 2016. Curtis goes straight to Rodham, which she says is a blunt, gritty, tough name from the Midwest. And it works for her novel. I mean, I the novel's pretty good. I don't love the book. It's a bit stiff. I mean, it's an act of ventriloquism that is fairly true to what you think Hillary would sound like, but there's no sort of interior sense of a real person in there. So that's what kept me from just loving the book.
Does she borrow it all from the memoir, or does it just sound, you know, as you say, like the ventriloquism isn't quite convincing?
No, she doesn't borrow from the memoir. I mean, she borrows a lot of facts. I mean, the book is fairly true to Hillary's mm-hmm. experience, at least up until age 25. And as you both know, Curtis Sittenfeld wrote a previous novel called American Wife, and it was told from the perspective of a character who was very, very much like Laura Bush. And that book did very well and was very well reviewed and was a bestseller. I suspect this book will be a bestseller too. I mean, it hits it right down the middle. I mean, it's not really my kind of thing, but it's kind of a well-made pop novel in a way. You know, it is what it is. I mean, it's not my kind of thing, but Curtis is a very talented writer.
When you both mentioned the memoir, I'm assuming you're talking about her first memoir, which I thought was really good, very forthright for the time, considering they were still very much in the public eye, and she probably knew that she might run for president someday. And I'm wondering if you feel like the voice feels authentic to that book.
It does. It sounds a lot like living history. Not in every regard. And, you know, Curtis, she has some fun with the Hillary character. I mean, there are things you will not read in Living History. There's some sex scenes in Rodham. She draws a discreet veil over them. There's no intensities, but very late in the novel, there's an important date that Hillary goes on, and she's kind of shy about it. She's probably in her 60s, and she brings condoms and KY jelly, and she's so sort of, you know, and she has her assistant get them for her, and she's, you know, she can't believe she's doing this. And there's things like that in the novel, which are really human.
It's interesting, Dwight. This probably draws a distinction between you and some other editors on the desk, because readers that I know have read the sex scenes and said, like, oh my, TMI here. This is a lot more detail than I needed to know about Hillary and Bill.
You know, I didn't feel that way. I felt the sex scenes were fairly well done. I mean, they're sort of PG. You know, there's nothing that is sort of going to frighten your aunt in her reading group when she eventually reads this, you know. I think they're pretty well done.
Both of you reviewed books that are political in nature. Jen, yours more so. What did you review this week?
I reviewed a book called Dark Mirror, and it's by Barton Gellman, who was one of the journalists whom Edward Snowden leaked that trove of top secret classified documents to back in 2013. And Gellman at the time was actually a freelancer after having been for a long time a military and diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post. And so the book recounts how he got to the Snowden story and how he actually did it for the Washington Post on a freelance basis, partly because the story was so incendiary and actually quite dangerous that he knew that he needed the institutional protection of a place like the Post. So the book is a combination memoir, but also he looks at how the American surveillance state was constructed, what it means, what it involves, what it entails for people. He also talks to a bunch of people who actually work in the national security establishment. And so the book it's not one-sided. I mean, it's very much from his perspective, but he tries to get a range of views on what's going on before coming to his own conclusions. And it's really excellent. You know, the way that it's told, there's sort of a noirish element, but it's not a parody of itself. I mean, you can tell that he came to this voice authentically from a long career reporting on this stuff, and he has a sense of humor about it. I mean, it's really, really good.
So you reviewed Snowden's own book for us earlier.
Yes.
How do the two books line up? I mean,
well, you know, it's interesting because Snowden's book, they're complementary in the sense that they don't dispute each other on the facts. I mean, from what I recall in Snowden's book, Gellman isn't a huge part of it. I mean, he's mentioned, but, you know, Snowden's book covers his whole life, and there's a lot of detail about how Snowden himself actually got a hold of these documents. And, you know, Gellman is focused more on what happened after that and how he was initially introduced to Snowden through Laura Poitras, the filmmaker. And, you know, initially the two of them, they're communicating with this guy who goes by the name Virax. And so they don't know who he is until the very last minute before Snowden hops on a plane to go to Hong Kong. And that's when he sends them a message, which, you know, the way Gellman describes it, it's, I think he calls it a breathtaking act of trust, where Snowden says, okay, he lists his name, his social security number, you know, the various positions that he's had as a contractor for the NSA. And the story, even though I feel like the broad outlines of it might be familiar to people who were paying attention in 2013, I mean, there's some stuff in here, just the details of how it all goes down that were just fascinating.
There's one detail I really like, and it has to do with a blender and,
oh, yeah,
and a kind of overarching idea of trust, which is obviously a major theme in the book. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So, you know, Gellman actually, unlike Greenwald and Poitras, who eventually hopped a plane to meet Snowden in person in that hotel room in Hong Kong, Gellman stayed in the States. And that was, you know, there's a large discussion about that. And that has to do with, you know, all kinds of issues with, you know, perhaps being spied on by Chinese intelligence in Hong Kong. I mean, it's very complicated. So the Washington Post tells him, you know, you shouldn't go, even though Gellman really wants to go. And so eventually he meets Snowden in person, I think, at the end of 2013. It's December. They meet in Moscow, where Snowden is living, and they meet at this, you know, sort of garish, gaudy hotel casino. And, Snowness is prickly. I mean, he makes clear to Gelman that he's annoyed with him, partly because I think one of the first stories that Gelman wrote, he mentions the name Virax. I think at the time Snowden hadn't revealed himself to the public. And so Gelman mentions the name Virax, and Snowden was still using that secret name at the time. And so he felt like that was a bit of a betrayal. But at the same time, you know, he respects what Gelman does. He respects him as a reporter. Gelman, in terms of Snowden, ultimately thinks that Snowden really showed himself to have a sincere worry for what the American surveillance state might mean for the American people. So, you know, they have this conversation, and Gelman's asking him a bunch of questions, including light lifestyle questions. And Snowden says how much he misses milkshakes in the U.S. And when Gelman asks him if he makes his own, you know, Snowden won't confirm or deny whether he has a blender, because apparently, I guess, blenders emit electronic signals. And so his location might be deduced from that. And he's a wanted man.
I mean, I got to ask all blenders, because I used to smoothie. I don't know. We make a smoothie this morning, and who knows?
I guess if you leak top secret documents, maybe somebody would be looking for you. But
looking for my blender. Right, yeah, I feel like exactly. No one's interested in, you know, whether I used organic strawberries or not in mine. We're having a kind of political conversation right now, so I thought it might be an appropriate moment to bring up a question from a listener. Declan Naughton writes to us a very nice note, and he asked, what is the best book that explains why, after an idealistic President Obama for 8 years, the American people chose President Trump? Thoughts?
So right now, it's hard to keep in mind, because it feels like the past several years have been the equivalent of something like 4 decades. But I think, you know,
I think you mean the past 3 months.
Well, there's also that too. There's also that too. I mean, I will say that actually one of the first books that I reviewed once I started writing about nonfiction for The Times was this book called How Democracies Die, which is a very dramatic title, by Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky, who are two professors. I think they're at Harvard. They take the view that regardless of your political, I guess, position, so they're not necessarily approaching this as, you know, partisans of the Democrats, but they do say that if you look at the Trump presidency, this was a long time in the making, in a way that really for the past several decades, there's been a real erosion of certain norms when it comes to governing. You know, they talk about Newt Gingrich and how he was really determined to make it impossible for Clinton to govern. They talk about McConnell at the end of Obama's presidency. They talk a little bit about what Democrats have done, but they do, I mean, I will say that ultimately, you know, they argue that the Republicans have been largely responsible for the past few decades of just making it look like government doesn't work and that government doesn't care about people. And somehow they've made it look like that's actually been the fault of Democratic presidents. And so, you know, they argue that Trump is really a symptom of something larger, and it's really a backlash. And they do talk about issues like race as well, which is also important to consider, that we had the first Black president, and there were some people who were very unhappy with that.
Dwight, any thoughts?
As you both know, I'm speaking to you both from West Virginia, where I was born and raised for the first part of my life, and where I am reporting a book for a year. And this question has really been on my mind in a serious way. And I will quickly just mention two books. They're very different. And then the obvious one is J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. And that book's politics are not quite mine. He is right of center. But what he does well, and he's a good writer, he gets at sort of the resentment people feel at being sort of left behind by where society's going, and the cultural cringe that people feel from some places in America. And he's good about the weight of the East Coast establishment pressing down and seeming like they know better than everyone else about how to live in the world. And he gets at those feelings pretty well. And those feelings are interesting to me. The other book I'll mention, and this comes from far left field, is William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, which I recently reread, and it just floored me. I mean, I liked it before, but it is sort of the great American novel in some regard about the sting of class awareness. It's about this character, Thomas Sutpen, who is from what became West Virginia, who travels to Mississippi near Oxford, where there's sort of a landed gentry, and he faces class for the first time. He wants to ask a question of one of the major landowners in town, and he goes to the front door and knocks, and a black man comes to the door and tells him he has to go around back. And this is the primal shock of his life, that a man won't even speak to him before telling him to go to the back door. And the novel is all about the rage to succeed and the rage to get revenge over this slight, and to understand what it is about people in the world that some people look down on other people. And it's just a really intense novel about that feeling. And it's maybe the best novel I've read about it. So those are two books that I would say help describe some of the things that people are feeling away from the centers, the coastal centers in America.
Let's run down the titles of the books that both of you reviewed again. And then also, if you would, the titles of the books you just recommended to our listener, Declan Naughton. Dwight?
I talked about Curtis Sittenfeld's new novel, Rodham.
And Jen?
I talked about Dark Mirror by Barton Gellman.
All right. And the books for Mr. Naughton and those others who are interested in how did Trump get elected after Obama?
I talked about J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy and also William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom.
I love the idea of everyone going to Faulkner to understand our current moment. Thank you, Dwight. And Jen?
And I talked about How Democracies Die by Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky.
All right. Thanks again to Dwight, our West Virginia-based critic slash correspondent, and Jennifer Salai from Brooklyn.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back. Not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.